Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show.
Hey, hey, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce Marable, CEO of Employee Cycle. And I have one question for all of you HR leaders out there. Are you tired of building those manual, painful, messy spreadsheets every time you're looking to perform HR reporting or look at your HR data? I know that's what you're dealing with because I talk to HR leaders every day about it. But look no further, because that's why Employee Cycle built your very own people dashboard for all of you HR leaders out there at small and medium companies that don't necessarily have the development resources or the internal analytics teams to be able to help you manage your data. So how do we do this? Our people dashboard has pre-built API connectors to the most popular HR systems you're all using. Systems like Bamboo HR, Namely, Zenefits, TriNet, ADP, Greenhouse, 15.5, Office 5, too many to name in this intro. And by connecting all those systems to the dashboard, we allow you to pull all the data into one place so you can view, track, share, and analyze it together. Please go to employeecycle.com to check us out, schedule a demo. Would love to talk to you and see how we can help you with your HR data needs. But that's enough about me and Employee Cycle, because today we have a very special guest, someone that I've known for years since I first got into the tech space. Please help me welcome to the show, Alex Hillman. He's the founder of Indy Hall and the 10,000 Independence Project. And today we're going to discuss why companies should provide an apprenticeship over an internship. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
I love the energy that you bring to the start of this show. It's awesome.
I'm ready. I'm here. I'm excited to have you here, and I'm excited to discuss the topic.
Same. This is a big one, an important one, and one that's near and dear to my heart.
Got it. So, Alex, I know you're not in the HR space, but I'm going to kick this thing off the best way we know how and slightly change the question. So my question to you is, how did you end up working in the wonderful world of HR?
Yeah, and I would say part of the way I got here is by actively avoiding it. My background, I cut my teeth in sort of the digital agency world, worked for a couple of medium-sized agencies, some small ones as a web developer. And then after a couple of years, ended up out on my own and choosing to run sort of a solo practice. And what I'd taken a bunch of things that I learned from one of my previous employers, which was in to this point in my career, still one of the best places I've ever seen in terms of a company culture and the elements of why people join a company, why people stay at a company, some incredible leadership, incredible management. I didn't know I was learning all those things at the time. And I look back in hindsight and realize how lucky I was to kind of get that as one of my first jobs out of college and realize that I was kind of spoiled for the rest of my career. And then when I went out on my own, I was sort of torn between, on one hand, realizing how good it could be, but also realizing how hard it is to be that good and not really wanting to build a giant team, but still really wanting to be around other people, being around creative people, bouncing ideas off of each other, being able to solve problems together, all the best parts of having coworkers. But I didn't want to be responsible for other people's paychecks. And so the way that I sort of grew my freelance and solo business practice was by starting Indy Hall, which almost 15 years later is still growing and thriving as this professional community of independents, entrepreneurs, freelancers, these days some remote workers and things like that, where the things we have in common aren't necessarily the skills that we have or the work that we do, but sort of the way we approach our work. And the environment, in a lot of ways, I'm always thinking about that amazing first job that I had where the focus of the company culture and how they hired and who they hired and how they managed and all of those things really came down to making sure that folks who need to work together have the opportunity to trust one another and build those that rapport and those relationships, because that's what unlocks collaboration and innovation. And so Indie Hall started in part because I didn't want to have HR. I didn't want to be HR. I didn't want to be responsible for a team, but I still wanted to be around other people. And so I found this kind of loophole in a way to surround myself with the people that I wanted to have as collaborators without being responsible for all of their income. And that turned into a whole business and community and thing of its own.
Got it. I love that. And can you give our audience a brief summary and overview of your 10,000 Independence Project?
Yeah, so this is sort of the new North Star. And I hesitate to call it new because in a lot of ways, it's also a return to roots. Like I was just saying, you know, a big part of Indie Hall's beginning was bringing together like-minded people to work on different things, but alongside each other, to share knowledge, share experience, to solve problems. And anyone who participated in that, including myself, got sort of a leg up in business, right? You didn't have to solve every problem new because you could watch other people solve problems and go, oh, I got to watch out for that next time. Or you could watch other people do new and interesting things, maybe that are normal in their corner of the industry or within their role, but are totally foreign to you. So many times I'd watch, you know, somebody in a sales role do their thing and realize that as a web developer, wow, there's things I could really learn here. I don't need to become a salesperson to get good at some of these sales skills. So I realize from the start how valuable that is. But I also realize how many people lack access to that sort of thing, especially in a city like Philadelphia, where we have massive economic disparity, and we have big businesses. In the case of what sparked the 10,000 Independence Project, it was when Amazon came to Philadelphia, as they came to cities across the nation and said, hey, we would love to put a headquarters in your city. All you got to do is give us a bunch of tax breaks and incentives, and we'll bring those 50,000 jobs. And everybody did backflips for Amazon. But I thought to myself, wait a second, that Amazon deal comes with a lot of strings attached and a lot of liability when it's one giant corporation creating those 50,000 jobs. So what would the Indie Hall version of creating 50,000 jobs look like? And it would look more like the way we started, which is making sure that more people have access to each other, access to the knowledge, experience, resources, and any other advantages that people find or build. If we can either share them with each other or teach each other how to build them, then maybe one of the best ways to create 50,000 jobs is to first help a smaller number of people become successful solo business owners, right? So it's a little different from building startup culture necessarily, because it's looking at things more broadly and saying, there's lots of people who could create a job for themselves, right? If they understood what skills they have, what abilities they have, what knowledge, what perspective they have that is valuable to other businesses, to other business owners, and then learn how to package that, learn how to sell that, learn how to market that, then, you know, some of those people, you know, in the best cases, they've created a, you know, a sustainable source of income that they can support themselves and their family, their neighbors, their neighborhood, and things like that. But in another layer, some of those people are going to go, wow, this is going really well. I didn't realize entrepreneurship was for me. But now that I've got it going, I think it'd be kind of cool to build a team. And now we've got the ability to also teach those folks who we taught how to build a sustainable business, how to build a sustainable team. And that last piece is sort of where I think your world is and ours start to collide, because it's these are people who aren't necessarily brought up, like myself, aren't necessarily brought up in a HR management world or culture, but then suddenly need to learn it, right? And so if we've got them from sort of phase one, where they're inspired to consider that entrepreneurship might be something that they would do, phase two, where they've got gone from, I launched the business, to, hey, this business is actually paying me better than I ever had in any job I've ever had. And I've got more freedom. And I've got, you know, I'm happier and I have more control over the work that I do and how I do it. But then the last piece is, I think those people have the potential to become the next and the best future generation of job creators, of managers, of people that are hiring for these teams and building these teams. So the 50,000 job number is sort of the second wave after we focus on the first 10,000 solo business owners. But I'm really excited about what potential we can unlock when the people who are creating the companies that are doing the hiring have a different set of goals, a different set of role models, and a different set of lessons that they've been taught to get them to the point where they're actually doing the hiring.
Got it. Thank you for that. So in our topic, we're discussing why companies should provide an apprenticeship over an internship. So before we go into which one is better and why, how do you define an apprenticeship? And then if we could take a second for you to define how you view and define an internship, and then we can start contrasting them and figuring out how do they overlap, but then also how do they differ?
Yeah. Well, I had this question myself as recently as a year ago, and I'll preface this with also the context that when I got into my career, part of the way I got in when I was looking at schools, I really wanted an educational program that had some sort of learning on the job component. And when I was growing up, the vocational schools were a big part of that. Maybe it was part of the second 2 years of high school or something along those lines. And then in some cases, people replaced a college. You know, maybe they couldn't afford going to college, or it just didn't match their path. And so trade schools were kind of like the home of where this learning on the job apprenticeship thing was. And it was different from an internship in such that on one hand it was structured, but more importantly, it wasn't here is exposure to the role that you want to have. This is actual practice. And I think maybe that's what I'm sort of getting towards is, for me, the delineation between an internship and an apprenticeship. I think internships are amazing, by the way. And if you're doing internships, you're doing incredible work and an important service in that you're providing somebody who maybe doesn't have, never mind the knowledge or experience, they don't even have the exposure to how the insides of your business or your industry work. So I view internships as a learning experience, but they're exposure driven, right? I might not be doing the most meaningful work in the organization as a person who doesn't really have the skills. That's kind of the point, but I'm not really there necessarily to do the work. I'm there to learn. I'm there to observe. I'm there to be in the room and sort of see how things go. And especially for young people, I think internships provide a lens into, is this even work that I want to do, right? Maybe I do an internship before I go down a deep dive and get a degree or a certification or something along those lines. So I see the internship as an exposure-based model. Now, I also recognize that lots of companies have leveled up their internships, and their interns do actually do real work. But I also see that getting into a dangerous territory where their interns are doing real work that they're not being paid equitably for. And that's partly because it's just a murky, undefined territory. And I think it's only gotten worse as depending on the industry. I think there's certain industries where this runs rampant, where interns are basically free labor that has limited experience, but it's sold to them as, you know, a college credit or that exposure that this can maybe get you your next bigger gig down the road. I think where an apprenticeship differs, it differs in a couple of different ways. The biggest one is, I think it maybe comes as a follow-on to an internship. An internship, again, is that sort of explorer mode. I think an apprenticeship is for somebody who's beyond exploring. They need practice. They need practical, hands-on, task-driven work. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, step one, step two, step three, assembly line work. That can be strategic work as well. But what they need is to get the reps in, right, before they can level up. And so where I think apprenticeships get really interesting is if you divide them down the line of, I don't know if the right term is formal, but there are certified apprenticeships that you can run through state government agencies and things like that. We can talk more about that in a minute. But you can also just run an apprenticeship as a company and treat it as a on-ramp for people who they've gone through, whether it's through internships or a boot camp or a certification, they've gone through the exploratory thing to figure out, is this even a thing I want to do? And now they've got the basic skills to do it, but they need the practice and then the guidance and the mentorship. So the big addition to an apprenticeship program, I'd say there are two. One is some form of structure, a path. If you think about the same way that In the world of HR, I believe people talk about this as like a ladder, right? There's, you start in one place and then you're leveling up through specific things. And in order to level up, you need to achieve certain milestones. A good apprenticeship over the course of 6 months is going to have milestones, so that in month one, you achieve that milestone, you'll level up. And in month two, you achieve the next milestone, you level up. So it's not just do whatever work our main staff doesn't have time to do. There is a built-in progression designed to help you get the practice. And any organization can do that. I think the key is making sure that there's people in the organization that are prepared to help design that progression, and then also be there to support that person. But the really interesting thing that I didn't know about until, like I said, about a year ago, is that you can, depending on the state you're in, and depending on the resources that are available, depending on the industry that you're in, there are programs that allow you to go through some additional paperwork. And depending on how big your organization is, that could be a showstopper, but it also might be, you know, less paperwork than you're used to in other parts of your hiring. And that actually opens up funding that allows you to subsidize these roles. And so it allows you to pay someone a living wage to get better at the skill that they want to get better at, and to provide value for you and therefore, you know, your customers, your clients, however your business is structured. And compared to an internship, which to me has always felt like a very, it's not that it's not reciprocal, but the company is typically benefiting far more than the intern is in terms of the economics of the exchange, whether it's paid or unpaid. But an apprenticeship, there's more of a win-win-win, especially if you go for that, you know, once you figure out, hey, apprenticeships actually really work for our team or for our company, there are more ways for you to take the apprenticeship model, make it part of your growth, make it part of your hiring plan, where at the end of an apprenticeship, that person, you've basically had a six-month opportunity to mold the perfect employee, right? They came out as sort of the, you know, came out of a certification or a course or a degree or whatever it is with some set of skills, but they need the practice. That way, when you hire them, you've already had 6 months to sort of shape them, both from a perspective of here's the way our company does it, or here's the way you can contribute the most to this company. And I think it sets up a different kind of long-term relationship between that person and the company that they're doing the apprenticeship with, because it's not just I learned things there. I think about that first company that I worked for. It wasn't called an apprenticeship, but the co-op program through Drexel that I went through, this company ran it more like an apprenticeship, where I had a specific point person who, over the course of 6 months, had me leveling up. And I went from barely knowing how to write HTML to leading front-end development teams inside of 6 months. You don't get that as an intern, but as an apprentice, if there's a path and people to guide you along the path, you end up with like fully functional team members for, and potentially even have the opportunity to have the costs of forming them subsidized by the programs that are out there.
I know we're getting a little granular here, but I always try to put myself in the mindset of an HR leader listening to our show. And so based off of what you're saying, are you advocating that the company should hire this person as a contractor, as a part-time employee? What does that look like?
That's a really good question. I've seen good examples in all varieties. I think that what's challenging is depending on the person and depending on the role and depending on the amount of value you believe they can provide the company on the other end of their apprenticeship. If you view those 6 months as an investment, then I think that helps shape why you would approach one or the other. So if you're a very small business, like you're talking less than 10 or 20 people, I could see an apprenticeship being a part-time role, right? Depends on how much work you've got, and it depends on how much that person needs to grow. But if I'm taking it as a part-time thing, you know, I guess the question of the difference between full-time or even if it's a part-time employee versus a contractor, for me, it comes down to, well, who are the people that you really want to have in your organization? And if we tie this all the way back to the 10,000 Independence Project, part of the reason I want to do this is because I want to encourage companies to hire people who are not from the standard hiring pool, right? That could be people coming from a wider range of experiences, wider range of economic experiences, wider range of life experiences. There's a big pool here in Philadelphia through an organization called JEVS that focuses on people that are immigrating to the U.S. and going through job training and then using apprenticeships to get them leveled up, it used to be just the trades. Now it's into creative skills and technology and things like that, which I think is super, super interesting. So I think it comes down to capacity is how I would, maybe there's two variables. One is, what is your capacity as an organization? And I wouldn't try to take on 10 apprentices at once. I would try like one, maybe two, and build it out as a model. Treat it like a way where you would build any new role. Give it that sort of degree of seriousness, and treat it like an investment. If you are at the point where you can hire people full time, I'd say the advantage to hiring people full time or even in a part time with benefits situation is you're going to have an application base that is more wide-ranging and diverse, because you're going to have people who, you know, if you're offering any degree of benefits, healthcare benefits, paid sick leave and things like that for the apprentices, that means that you can attract people who can afford, who couldn't afford to not have those things, right? And so I think, again, this comes back down to goals, but the reason I think apprenticeships are this really interesting path is you get to treat a candidate as like an early stage investment for the company and end up with sort of the perfectly molded candidate. But you also get to open up those possibilities, open up those opportunities to a wider range of candidates than who you're already getting. So if you as a company are trying to widen the pool of who you're hiring, and if you're finding that it's hard to attract diverse candidates, then part of that is because you're not meeting them where they are, right? And so I come at it from a perspective of an apprenticeship, well-designed, whether it's contract or part-time or full-time, the answer to that is going to be dependent on who are you trying to meet, what are their needs, and how can your company provide for those needs to get them in the door at that earlier stage.
And then the last question that I have, which I'm sure a lot of HR leaders are thinking, is, are there roles that you believe are best suited for this apprenticeship model than others? And if so, what are some of the roles that you think are best? And then what do you think are some of the roles that you don't necessarily see this working?
That's a really good question. I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but I've thought about pieces of it. And I think there's two kinds of roles. One are, I mean, let's look back at, again, where do apprenticeships come from? They come from the trades, right? We go back hundreds or thousands of years. You learn to become a blacksmith or to shoe horses from the person in town who was already a blacksmith or already put shoes on horses. And that was, you know, modernized to plumbers and electricians and things like that. And I think if you were to modernize a lot of those trades, they map really well to a lot of, I'll call them crafts, right? Digital crafts. So design and development, copywriting, things that don't necessarily need to be super duper high strategic. There's got to be someone strategic in the room, but there also needs to be people who are doing the implementation, right? So I think that if there are roles, and these are clearly going to be junior roles for the most part, where someone can learn the basic skills through a certification or a training course to do programming or some sort of technology work for either a certain technology that your company uses or a piece of software that your company uses, someone who's going to be kind of hands-on. And I would also say, if you're getting started, trying to start with things that are not mission critical, right? Because you're gonna have to learn a few things here. So maybe internal projects is a safe place to start. Are there internal projects that need hands? And the people in the company are busy, you know, putting out fires for clients or customers, whatever it might be. That's a good place to start. The other area that I think is really underrepresented is in communication roles. And I think even more specifically in things like customer support. And the reason for that is I think about all the people who are in retail jobs. And basically customer support is what they do all day long, except retail jobs have, you know, at the bottom end of the pay grade. And culturally, they're often looked down on, which is a bummer because those people work really, really hard. And many of them are actually very good at their jobs. But if you're now in a technology company or, you know, a mid-sized services company, somebody who's got great customer service skills from retail that can be trained into sort of the core competencies of your vertical, of your customer base and things like that. Someone who's hungry to learn and has good customer service skills from, again, retail, food service, things like that, I think make amazing candidates for this. I've had such great success hiring people that have done hospitality and food service work and that are, you know, therefore very much customer focused, customer centric, teaching them sort of the fundamentals of whatever industry we're working in, and then having them work up around a craft to help support those customers. They've got the best candor. They've got the best communication skills. They just need the context to deploy them in. And now you're going from, you know, earning $25,000, $30,000 a year in a retail job that's, you know, got very limited ceiling for growth. Now you're learning how to support, maybe do account support, account management. You might realize that, wow, you've got a knack for getting customer feedback, and now you've got an opportunity to grow into a product role. So I think front lines communication and support, and not the kind of thing that you would consider outsourcing necessarily, but the in-house stuff where it's high value, I think there's a lot of room there that is not being thought about or capitalized on within lots of businesses.
Alex, thanks so much for coming on our podcast and sharing your views and this interesting take around apprenticeships. We always like to have people that are pushing new ideas and giving our audience new ways to think about their role and how they can make their company better. So really appreciate that and really appreciate you being on the show. Go, Alex. Woo!
Super, super glad to be here. This is fun stuff to talk about. As you can tell, I'm passionate about it. And, you know, if folks are doing this sort of thing, I'd love to. I'm still learning about this too. So if you've got a good example of an apprenticeship in motion or things that you've learned, let's consider this a two-way street. And I'm very interested in hearing from folks that have overcome challenges in this space. I'm making it sort of my goal to be there to support people. We're going to be running these on our own through our own programs. But I know more people, more organizations are looking to do this sort of thing, and I would love to hear from folks. If anybody wants to drop me an email, alex@indiehall.org. I always love hearing from folks.
Awesome. And I was just about to ask, where can people find you online? So you already did half of my job for me, but you also just launched the book. Can you just give us a quick 30-second spiel of title, what it's about, and where people can find it and or buy it?
Yeah, thank you. Always an opportunity to plug the book. So the book is The Tiny MBA. You can get it at tiny.mba. That's the URL. And it is a very short book. You can read it cover to cover in about 30 minutes. But it is for people who are, even if you are not an entrepreneur, people who are in the business world are finding, all different categories are finding this book really, really valuable. It's different from most business books in that it's not going to try and beat you over the head with an idea and 17 case studies, and it's not going to try and be, you know, a owner's manual compendium of everything you need to know about business. It's 100 very short lessons, one lesson per page. The lessons are the length of like a tweet or a LinkedIn post. They're, you know, just a few sentences long, but they're there to sort of spark ideas and help you think outside of the box, help you problem solve, help you think about business from a long view perspective. So if you work in a business realm where you're any sort of decision maker, you're the kind of folks that I've heard finding this book really, really valuable. It's available in paperback as well as digital for your Kindle and things like that. All of those are available at tiny.mba.
Awesome. And we'll definitely include the book in the show notes as well. So if this is your first time coming to the Employee Cycle Podcast and you came here because you're already a super fan of Alex and you had to hear what he had to say, or you thought that this topic was compelling and you gave it a listen, but now you're hungry for more episodes, please go to employeecycle.com and sign up for our podcast newsletter. Or you can go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or all other major podcast players and subscribe to the Employee Cycle Podcast. Also, if you enjoyed this episode as much as Alex and I did making it, then please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And last but not least, all of you super awesome HR and people leaders out there, please continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks. Later, kids. Yeah.